Hello and welcome to episode 15 of the HMEB podcast. I'm your host, David Cuff, the executive editor of HME Business Magazine, your source for news, trends, and insights into the home medical equipment industry. This episode is a special edition on the risks of fire when it comes to home oxygen service and comes to you courtesy of our sponsors, BPR Medical Gas Control. The issue of fires when it comes to home oxygen is something that I think all respiratory equipment and service providers keep in the back of their minds, but they might not have a quantitative understanding of the issue. However, just released is a new study, The Prevalence and Impact of Home Oxygen Fires in the U.S., and it goes into considerable detail on the subject. Here to talk about that topic and the study is Richard Radford. Richard is the Managing Director of BPR Medical Gas Control, the UK-based manufacturer that's behind that study. Richard, how are you doing this morning?
I'm good, thank you, Dave.
So let's dive in. What is the danger of fire when it comes to home oxygen? Why don't you describe that for the listeners?
Yeah, well, I think everybody in home oxygen knows that oxygen supports combustion, but what isn't really appreciated, I don't think, is just how easy and how fast an ignition can happen. We've done a lot of research into how oxygen fires actually begin, and we've designed experiments and we've done a lot of testing. So we have a pretty good understanding of the dangers of fire in a home oxygen environment. What we do know is that oxygen fires happen at very low flow rates, lower than previously thought about. Most patients are on 2 to 4 liters a minute of oxygen. That's the bulk of the market. And our research shows that when you're looking at flows below 2 liters per minute, you are indeed actually creating the conditions for an oxygen fire. And given that's the fact, put simply, anyone smoking while on oxygen, in effect, is entering a game of Russian roulette. And I think what the study has shown us is that some oxygen users lose that game.
Yeah.
Now, you can argue that people are warned not to smoke, and of course that is the case, and the home care sector has taken this view for some decades. But a question whether oxygen users can really understand the level of risk. Now, we've done a lot of research, as I mentioned, and so we really do understand the conditions and the level of risk and danger. And service providers have been warning patients for years, but the evidence now tells us that it isn't effective on its own, as we'd all hope. And if you think a little bit about perhaps why patients continue to smoke and why they take that risk, oxygen is a colourless, odourless gas. It's a bit like air from their experience. And if you add into that mix perhaps the nicotine dependence, perhaps they've got poor mobility, a limited quality of life, the cigarette is their last pleasure. We often hear that back anecdotally. And there's that natural human bias. It just won't happen to me.
Yeah.
And without condoning it, it's not difficult to see why people still smoke whilst on oxygen. And that's important because people are being injured and killed, and that's what the study is showing. I think the study also shows, Dave, that it's not just oxygen users who are affected. The findings from the study show that third parties are also injured and killed, and that included emergency services and members of the public as well. So this is an important issue.
So what's the incidence of home oxygen fires in the United States?
Well, it's been quite difficult to establish because there is no single measurement system in the US. In fact, the only place there is a single measurement system is in the UK, so figures there are quite strong. The National Fire Protection Association, the NFPA, have established over the years two important rates, one from their landmark paper in 2015. And what the NFPA estimate, and the NFPA also say that it is an underestimate, is that the likely number of burn victims in any year is probably about 1,200 cases. And the second rate that's quite important is that the death rate nationally in the US is around 70 people per year. Now, the study we've just released, which is probably the most comprehensive study in this particular area, has used Google Alerts to pick up the media news reports around the US on home oxygen fires. And the headline figures from that really are that we found 311 incidents of fire which led to 164 deaths, 73 severe serious injuries, and 109 minor injuries, which was done over a 20-month period.
Wow.
Now, 11 of those 164 deaths were actually third parties, which is what I mentioned a bit previously. That included family members, other residents, a residential care worker, and a firefighter. But the numbers, the incident is difficult, as I mentioned. And I believe that even these numbers are higher, although they are higher than what the NFPA suggested, are still probably likely underestimates. The way that we found the information was, as I said, through a Google alert.
Yeah.
But not all fires actually make the news to begin with. So we can't capture those fires that didn't make the news. Not all the news reports on fires that did happen would have had the keywords that we were looking for.
Sure.
To return. Google alert, we don't know whether it picked up everything, and there will be some sites that it doesn't get to. And we haven't counted of the serious injuries that occurred, how many of those went on then, unfortunately, to die of their injuries. And there is studies around this area which looks at least 15% of serious burns from home oxygen fires then lead on to death while still in hospital. So none of those things are included in the figures. But what it all translates to is probably, well, it's definitely 100 deaths per year, but it's probably somewhere between 100 and 150 deaths a year, which is about 1.5 to 2 times worse than we'd previously thought as an industry.
Got it.
So that's the sort of incidence rate in the US.
Yeah, and like you said, the agencies are underreporting this. I'm curious, Richard, do you have any idea why it's underreported? Is it just because it's something that might be off the radar of these agencies or anything like that?
Well, previously we did some work with the FDA looking at their MAUDE database, which is the reporting database for medical device manufacturers. And there's a very clear underreporting of the fires. I think we looked at 2016 and the number of fires there was reported was 11. And given the numbers that I've just quoted, you can see clearly. So the probable reasons for that, one would be that the people that install oxygen systems are not medical device manufacturers. They're in effect a distributor. And distributors aren't required under medical device reporting to report into the MAUDE database. I think that's probably the main reason. But there's also this belief that the problem is caused by the patient and that there's not a requirement to report it because of that reason. And I think that's a little tricky from a regulatory perspective because if the concentrator that you install says that you should fit a fire break, and nearly all concentrators now require in their instructions for use to fit a fire break, and you don't, then in effect you are not installing the oxygen concentrator in the way that it was instructed to by the manufacturer of the concentrator. So there's a grey area there.
Uh-huh.
But at the end of the day, these things are being underreported in quite a serious way. And that's consistent across the world from what we can gather. We do work the European regulatory agencies as well, and also in Japan. And we know in both of those jurisdictions, they both also underreport significantly to the competent authority.
Oh, well, and going by what you've been able to uncover so far, 100 to 150 deaths a year, I think you said that is significant. How does that compare with the rest of the world?
Great to say, it doesn't compare favorably. If we take the lower number, let's just take 100 deaths per year, and if we assume that the oxygen population in the US is 1.5 million, and that's quite difficult to grasp, but that seems to be about the median response when you're looking for oxygen user numbers. The 100 deaths over 1.5 million equates to a 6.7 deaths per year per 100,000 oxygen users, and that's the number, that's the ratio that we use to create equivalence and comparison between different countries. So if you compare that 6.7 with, say, Japan, where we have reasonably strong numbers from Japan, the equivalent rate in Japan is 3.3 per 100,000. So it's half that in the US for a comparable number of oxygen users. However, if you look at the best practice, and that's all pointing to the UK at the moment, the equivalent study in England found just one death over a five-year period. And the equivalent rate is 0.34 per 100,000. So that's 20 times better than in the US. So if we then take that to the 100 deaths, or you had 100 deaths in a year, that would be 5 deaths if the UK practice was applied universally across the US.
Well,
it's a big difference, I understand.
Yeah. So
fundamentally, Dave, the oxygen delivery is the same around the world. You have an oxygen concentrator in the home and cylinders or a portable oxygen concentrator for ambulatory use. But there are differences from country to country in how the service is delivered. So whether it's the size of the market or the size and the type of the home oxygen provider. In the US, the construction method for housing is predominantly wood, and that's a big problem in a fire, whereas a brick house may behave differently. The level of cooperation between stakeholders, so whether that's the emergency services, the service provider, and the medical staff, that differs in different countries, and that seems to be an important point as well.
Mm-hmm.
The regulations and the reporting, the risk assessment, the method by which you do that, and the rigor with which that's undertaken, and also things like enforcement of smoke alarms and the fitting of fire breaks. These things differ from country to country. And if you look at coming back to the UK as best practice, according to the evidence, we have a small number of established home oxygen providers. It's a carefully regulated market with mandatory reporting of safety incidents. There's a culture of the stakeholders working together. The risk assessment, for example, actually checks whether there's a working smoke alarm.
Oh.
And if there isn't, then the fire and rescue department are advised, and they physically follow up and check and fit a smoke alarm. So these things are different. And of course, fire breaks are mandated and have been in the UK since 2006. So all of these differences, and some of these differences are quite structural. The idea of stakeholders working collaboratively is quite difficult in some markets. And that's, I think you'd accept that's quite a challenge for any regulatory body to change. But fitting of smoke alarms and fire breaks is a relatively low cost, high return intervention that perhaps could be looked at.
So how do home oxygen fires start in the first place? And how can devices like fire breaks help to mitigate the risk?
So an oxygen user, if they are smoking, and generally that's in their favorite chair or perhaps in bed at night, during the inhale process, and I won't go into the technical reasons why that is, but what will happen is that the whole cigarette, the outside of the cigarette, will actually ignite because of the higher oxygen concentrations around the mouth and the nose created by the oxygen flow. That's how this fire starts. We've established that for the first time, I think. What then happens is the nasal cannula will then catch underneath, and will then the fire will effectively eat into the PVC very quickly, and the fire is established in the oxygen line. The fire will then burn back through the PVC tubing towards the oxygen source. Now, the ignition time of that, from the cigarette igniting through to the nasal cannula igniting, depending on the flow rate and the concentration, will be anywhere from 3/4 of a second to a quarter of a second. So it happens, as far as the user is concerned, almost instantaneously.
Good Lord.
And we have good video evidence of that, and we now know the mechanism, which is an important breakthrough, because once you understand how these things start, you can start to look at ways of mitigating the risks. Mm-hmm. You mentioned fire breaks. So a fire break is a safety device that fits into the oxygen tubing close to the patient. It stops the flow of oxygen if the oxygen tube itself ignites,
uh-huh.
which then in turn stops the fire, because PVC won't burn in ambient air. The action is actually automatic, so it will stop the fire in its tracks and will effectively protect the oxygen source. So you haven't got the tube acting as a conduit for the fire, which will take it around the house back to wherever the oxygen is coming from, be that a concentrator or a liquid oxygen source or a cylinder. So this limits the fire. It limits the production of the byproducts of combustion of PVC, which are pretty horrendous. Apart from it being a very black smoke, it is laden with hydrogen chloride, and they are fatal levels produced from burning PVC tube. Obviously, the longer the tube and the longer the burn, the more hydrogen chloride that is produced, and that's one of the things the study looks at as some additional research. But it buys evacuation time. It limits the scale of the fire, and in so doing, it can prevent injury and death, and limits the damage that come as a consequence of effectively a whole house fire. So for a few dollars, for something that lasts 4 years, they're a pretty low cost, relatively easy risk control measure to implement, and they work.
So what about the implementation of fire breaks in the United States versus other places? How does the United States match up, I guess?
Well, the adoption across the world is slow. That's the medical device industry anyway. We understand that things change pretty slowly. The standards around this area have changed probably over 12, 13 years now, and they're still in change as it happens. But most standards now have included in them a need for fire breaks that need to be fitted to patient oxygen circuits. Countries around the world beyond the regulations have already early adopted this product. The UK mandated, as I said earlier, the fitting of fire breaks back in 2006. In Germany in 2012 was mandated. It's a regulatory requirement now under CE marking in Europe, so all European countries are required to fit fire breaks. Japan is moving towards adoption. It's a fairly big oxygen market, Japan. And they will have full mandation by February 2021. In fact, across the world, we have 25 countries that are fitting fire breaks now as routinely. I think in the US, adoption has been slower. But March in 2018, the VA took a decision to put out a patient safety alert, which required fire breaks to be fitted to all of their patients. So some really very positive news from the VA back in 2018, which will make a difference. And part of that patient safety alert that they released was also to set up a reporting structure, which I think is an important thing to do. However, the VA amounts to somewhere around 6 or 7% of the whole market for oxygen users in the US. So if we want to make an impression on the 100 to 150 deaths a year, then more change is required beyond what the VA have done.
Gotcha. What are some of the regulatory changes that you would like to see happen? Is this something that would happen at like the CMS/HHS level?
Well, I mean, ideally, I think one of the limitations is that this is an additional cost, and it is only a few dollars per unit. But with a big oxygen population, that's an additional cost. and that's been an inhibitor, we think. So it would be nice to see reimbursement. It would be nice to see positive messages from regulators. But at the end of the day, the medical device industry has always worked to reduce risk based upon the evidence they provided.
Mm-hmm.
And the report that we've, the study that we've done, hopefully adds to the weight of information and knowledge in this area to enable regulators and service providers to make decisions.
Are there some other kind of key points that came out of the study that you think might help kind of push that dial a bit?
Yes, I think so. I mean, the headline figures I mentioned earlier, 311 instances, 164 deaths, but there are some other really interesting findings that came out of it. For instance, the impact of on third parties, which I've already touched upon. In fact, we measured and looked at the number of evacuations and how people evacuated. So where people actually did evacuate and required assistance, the majority of people that assisted were members of the public, either neighbours or other residents or family members. And there was more of those evacuations than there were of police or firefighters. So members of the public are actually going in on an altruistic basis and evacuating people. So that's a risk to them. In fact, I think I mentioned of the 164 deaths, 11 were third parties that passed away also.
Mm.
We also discovered that one in three instances that we recorded, at least one cylinder exploded, which creates a very big problem, a big risk to third parties, fire services, and an unpredictable one as well. And I think one of the deaths, the firefighter that died as a third party that we recorded, was actually hit by a cylinder, an exploding cylinder. So these things are real and they're a problem. And when we actually look at why cylinders explode, because cylinders are actually fitted with safety devices, thermal safety devices, which should reduce the pressure inside the cylinder. But there's clear evidence that that doesn't necessarily work in certain situations and in certain fire cases. And with one in three instances resulting in an oxygen cylinder explosion, that seemed an awfully large number to us.
Yeah.
So we did some more work on that area. And what you have to understand is that with a rising temperature, you're not only increasing the gas pressure in the cylinder, you're also structurally weakening it. So even at 500 degrees Fahrenheit, you've more than halved the strength of the cylinder and you've doubled the pressure. And 500 degrees Fahrenheit, just to put context there, is a very modest home fire. Typically, they can go to 600 degrees Fahrenheit and higher.
Yeah.
And what we also wondered was if the oxygen tube was burning back, by the time it gets to the cylinder, so we measured the temperature of the flame that's on the PVC tube, and that's at 1400 degrees Fahrenheit. So that is a possible that we're weakening the cylinder from the oxygen tube. That's a hypothesis that you could also look at. So where the heat comes from, we can't say for certain, and there probably needs more testing to be done. But what we do know is that in one in three instances, a cylinder's going to explode. But the other thing that the study showed was the type of property that people lived in. If you are in a mobile home, you're an oxygen user, your risks are much, much greater. So statistically, an oxygen user is already 8 times more likely to die in a residential fire than a US citizen that's not on home oxygen. If that oxygen user is living in a mobile home, then they are 24 times more likely to die in a residential home fire than a US citizen not on oxygen at all. There's a disparity in oxygen users of 3 times based upon the property type they live in from the evidence that we've taken from the study. And we just thought that was interesting.
Absolutely.
Partly from some of the anecdotal records that we took, there are state fire marshals saying that building regulations for mobile homes changed, and some of the early models are quite dangerous from a fire point of view. And it's not an area that we're expertise in, but it's just reporting some of the things that came out of the study. But we took a lot of time and effort to actually look at lots of aspects of the incidents that we were researching, and from that data we were able to sort of piece together and pivot data to see how these things panned out. And I think it's just a level of detail that we now have around home oxygen fires that we didn't have before.
Well, it's definitely kind of sobering and staggering, those findings. I'm curious, you know, now that we have this kind of information, obviously, you know, there's a drive to address it, but, you know, the regulatory and legislative front, you know, can take a while. It's like parallel parking a glacier. So what can happen in the private sector? Can home oxygen providers start doing things to prevent these fires?
Well, they can. You're right. Regulation in medical devices works slowly, but it works.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the day, there is nothing to prevent service providers, DMEs, from fitting fire breaks in their patient circuits. They're commercially available. They're not hugely expensive, and the instructions for use for oxygen concentrators already say fit a fire break. So those things are in place, the standards are in place, the momentum towards their adoption across the world is in place. As I say, at the end of the day, the medical device industry always works to reduce risk. It always has done, and it's done that very successfully over the years. We just hope that the evidence that we've now provided in this study report will move towards the right decisions being made.
Well, so the study, of course, we've got that covered on the HME Business website, and we'll provide links to it. The site is hme-business.com. But if providers want to find out more about you guys, Richard, where can they go online to get some additional information?
Well, we released this study yesterday against International Patient Safety Day. And if they want more information on fire breaks, there's a microsite called firebreaks.info, which provides the latest information on standards, adoption, information around fire breaks, how to fit them, everything you probably need to know. So that's firebreaks.info. If they want to know about BPR Medical, we are bprmedical.com.
All right. Well, Richard, thank you very much for providing your time and your information. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Dave.
You'll notice Richard mentioned International Patient Safety Day, and that was on September 17th, the day before we recorded our interview. Thanks again to Richard Radford, and thanks again to sponsor BPR Medical Gas Control for supporting this episode. Remember, if you want to learn more about firebreaks, check out firebreaks.info. If you want to learn more about BPR Medical, make sure to go visit them at bprmedical.com. And if you want to read more about and download that study, you can go to hme-business.com and check out our news, or you can go over to bprmedical.com and you can find it under the latest news section on their homepage. That'll close things up for episode 15. Remember, if you want to stay on top of what's happening in the industry, make sure to check out hme-business.com and subscribe to eSource, our weekly e-newsletter service. And if you haven't done so, make sure to go to the website and subscribe to the print magazine there as well. Again, that's hme-business.com. Of course, you can follow us on social media. We're at HME Business on both Facebook and Twitter, and I'm at Post Acute News on Twitter. And let's not forget this podcast. Don't forget to rate and review the HME Business podcast. And please, if you haven't already, make sure to click on the subscribe button so that you get every new episode. Remember, you keep listening and we'll keep posting. Lastly, if you have any feedback, suggestions, or requests, don't be afraid to reach out to me via Twitter. Again, that's at Post News. Or you can hit me up on email at DKO, P as in Paul, F as in Franklin, at 1105media.com. With that, we'll wrap things up. Thank you all very much for listening, and goodbye until the next HMEB podcast.